recent headline from the Barna Group reads, "Almost half of practicing Christian millennials say evangelism is wrong." The Barna Group has been conducting research on the faith-sharing experiences and expectations of Christians and non-Christians alike, and it seems that many millennials now believe that it's wrong to share their faith. Join us as we dig into the data, talk through the implications, and think forward about what this means for the church as we talk with Barna's David Kinneman on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania at the CPYU Studios. Jason Sochnick, who is our able-bodied co-host, is with us as well. And Jason, you are not in Spokane. You're actually sitting outside in Arizona. What town are you? Are you in Phoenix or where are you?
I'm actually in Glendale, Arizona.
Okay.
So taking in some spring training, hanging out with family.
Gotcha. And we're going to hear some animals and things, right? I mean, you're out in the midst of the wildlife, so we may hear some birds.
Yeah, you make it sound like I just slept outdoors and I meandered to the nearest Wi-Fi spot to do an interview. But no, I'm staying somewhere. I just went outside because it was going to be a lot better.
Okay, well, good. Well, I'm glad you're here, and we are going to have a conversation. We're going to jump into it very quickly here with our friend David Kinneman from the Barna Group. David, I know, is familiar to most of the folks who listen to us, and he is the author of several best-selling books, including Good Faith, You Lost Me, and Unchristian. He is now the president of the Barna Group, a leading research and communications company. They work with churches, nonprofits, and businesses ranging from film studios to financial services, and he has done some great work on behalf of the church that really has benefited so many of us in the world of youth ministry. And we are happy to have David Kinneman here. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Walt. It's been fun to be friends for so long, and thanks for those kind words.
Yeah, do you remember the last time you and I encountered each other? We ran into each other. Do you remember where that was? I was thinking about that this morning.
No, I don't remember that, but I do remember the very first time I met you.
I don't know if I want to ask about that. The way you said that makes me a little, yeah, all right, you can ask about it, Jason.
Well, we want to hear about both of these encounters.
What was the first time?
I had just written Unchristian, and I was at Jubilee. I think I might have, I had read your books and was like a huge fan and all the rest. So I was like, you know, sort of doing the fanboy thing, and you came in, you wanted to do a podcast with me, and I just was so flattered that you wanted to do that. So it was a pretty cool moment for me.
Yeah, well, you know, the last time we saw each other, this was a lot of fun. I forget, Lisa and I were traveling somewhere, and we landed in Denver, and we were way down at one end of one of the terminals. It was very crowded, and I think I had said to her as we got off the plane and rounded the corner, I said, there are so many people in here. We are bound to see someone we know. And lo and behold, we walked up, and there you were.
That's my extra room at my second house is at the Denver airport, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you, so you were the first person that I remember seeing in the Denver airport. And then just this last, about a year ago after the NFL draft, I came through the same hallway and about the same spot you were standing, I look up and there is Baker Mayfield. And of course, I didn't go up and talk to him, but you know, Browns quarterback now. But that was kind of fun. So I've got to go by that place all the time. I'm going to run into somebody.
It's like the third dimension, man.
Yeah, Denver Airport. So let's talk about what you guys have been doing at the Barna Group. You had a study come out recently, I think back in the beginning of February, if I'm correct, where it was all about millennials and evangelism. And I'd love to hear, you know, what you folks found out from that. What is, you know, we've got a lot of youth workers and parents who are listening. Of course, we talk hear about culture. We love tracking with you, what you guys are doing. So what did you find out about millennials and evangelism?
Well, we were doing this large study for Alpha, which of course is the sort of the course, the seeker course that came out of Holy Trinity Brompton in London with Nikki Gumbel. And so here in the U.S., we were working with Alpha. We've been working with them on a lot of different projects. And part of our goal was to understand sort of people's perceptions of evangelism, and in particular, what are the attitudes towards evangelism and faith sharing among the next generation. And so the real surprise of that study, or maybe not so much of a surprise, but the real shocking statistic was that 47% of practicing Christian millennials say they believe that it's wrong to share their faith with someone in the hopes that they might become a Christian. And so that was a real, you know, sort of you might say half of practicing Christians say evangelism is wrong, to sort of headline it. And I think that raised a lot of eyebrows, a lot of discussion. It's one of the more talked about statistics we've released in the last year or two. And I think it reflects this sense that young people have about living in a, you know, pluralistic, lots of friends who are different, and that we can sort of, how do we talk about the goals of evangelism? What do we want out of it? It was funny because there's this huge paradox that 94% of practicing Christian millennials say that the best thing that could ever happen to someone is for them to come to know Jesus. So it's not that they don't believe that Jesus might actually be good for someone. There's just this real sense about being wary about sort of evangelistic pursuits, or, you know, sort of proselytizing someone else. So I think that was one of the real headlines from the study.
Mm. Now, just to clarify, as you folks put up parameters, you know, date and age parameters for the different generations, you folks would put millennials born 1984 to 1998, basically their ages 20 to 24. How, with what they came up with, you know, in terms of the 47%, how does that compare to the prior generations that you surveyed?
Yeah, so among Gen X, that's my generation, there are 27% who said they believe it is wrong. And the precise language of the statement in the survey was, it is wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith in hopes that they will one day share the same faith. And so it's 47% of millennials, 27% of Gen X, 19% of boomers, that's your generation, Walt, and then 20% of elders. Which I think is interesting. I mean, it's one out of five at minimum, even among older generations, who say they have some sort of misgiving, or they actually, you know, again, agree strongly to the statement that it's wrong to share one's faith. And so, you know, it's not just a millennial issue or sort of millennial hangup. It's just that millennials have a higher percentage who agrees with that. Another area that's actually even a more stark difference in the study was, we asked the question, if someone disagrees with you, it means that they're judging you. And 40% of millennials, 22% of Gen X, 9% and 11% of boomers and elders respectively agree. And again, I think it kind of connects with something we found a few years ago in this book you mentioned called Good Faith, that, you know, this idea that if someone you can't criticize someone else's life choices, or you can't, you know, there's this new sort of moral code where if you talk about something in a way that offends somebody, you know, sort of trigger warnings and, you know, the various concerns that people have, there's this real hypersensitivity of saying something that might offend somebody. And actually there's a lot of merit to that. I mean, we understand why that has become part of the popular imagination, but this notion that, you know, to criticize someone else's life choices is actually a new kind of moral wrong in today's society. Mm.
Go ahead, Jason. I just want to mention, by the way, can I say, for people who are listening, normally Jason and I can see each other, so we know who's going to ask a question, who's not. So we might, as we're doing now, speak over each other. So Jason, just jump in. All right.
Yeah, definitely. I am curious with regards to the data. You mentioned the worry of offending. Were there any other aspects to the data that you collected that might speak into this 47% feeling like it's wrong, or was that one of the main factors?
Well, you know, survey research has so many limitations, which it's important, I think, for a survey researcher to admit to. It's not always fun to say, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of things we don't know, but that's just the honest truth. And so there's a lot of things we can't really tell from this. What I sort of think of our work as being a perception scientist. We are good listeners. We try to reflect what other people think and say. We report on the questions that we ask, and then we let church leaders, parents, you know, the society in general make their own sense of this. I mean, I think you could look at a lot of different factors that we've been studying among the next generation for many years. Certainly their religious context is much less Christianized. So they have many more friends who aren't Christian. While still a majority of American young people identify as Christian, there is far more attention given, more pluralism, religious pluralism in their context. We see, you know, pop culture in various ways making Christianity, and especially evangelicalism, it's like you're sort of stupid if you believe this stuff. And we found, you know, some of the self-perceptions of millennial Christians is that they're afraid to speak up. They feel misunderstood. They're not sure how to have a difficult conversation with somebody who has a different faith than they are. And by the way, that's not unique to this young generation of Christians. I think one of the more mega trends that we see in American culture is the decline of being able to talk across boundaries. We did a study a few years ago that showed that, you know, most people say they would have a very difficult time having a natural and normal conversation with someone who is different from them. That could be an LGBT person with an evangelical or a Muslim with an atheist. I mean, we're really breaking up into a lot of tribal units within our culture. So millennials, I think, just reflect that broader trend for sure. Mm.
You know, as I'm looking at your infographic here, and people can find this at Barna.com with the study on millennials oppose evangelism. I'm looking at this infographic, and two of the stats that really hit me. The one is the one you mentioned, you know, where millennials are the highest by, you know, 20 percentage points over the previous generation. You know, 47% is wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith in hopes that they will one day share the same faith. And then right above that, millennials are the highest in saying, I am gifted at sharing my faith with other people. How did you have any conversations in terms of how to reconcile that? In other words, I'm gifted to do this, but I'm not going to use my gifts because I think that would be wrong. Is that a way to interpret that? Or
yeah, that's a really good point. And it's funny. I mean, you're the first person who has even asked about that. And I suppose that's partly on us for not showing even shining an even brighter light on that particular statistic. You know, one of the other aspects of millennials that's really interesting is they really do like to talk. And they again, this is their perception. This is their self-perception. And again, perception doesn't always equal reality, but it certainly is an important sense of how they think about their world. But we find this in another study we had done with a group called Luther and Our Ministries on spiritual conversations in the digital age. We also found this really at length in the evangelism study that that millennials enjoy spiritual conversations. They like talking about faith. You know, the old adage that you don't talk about religion at politics at a dinner party does not hold true at all for this generation. They are willing to weigh in on, you know, on politics, on, you know, on social media issues. I mean, just all cultural issues, what's streaming on Netflix, you know, and on faith and religion. And again, I think there's a really interesting way of thinking about the context for this. Again, I find myself being both a critic but also a huge apologist or a defender of millennials and now Gen Z, two older Christians who sort of say, you know, well, this generation just doesn't get it. And I understand some of those concerns, but I think that it's really easy to blame a generation that we raised and to not acknowledge some of the great gifts that they bring. And the new world in which they're living in. And I think this particular statistic that you've mentioned, the fact that 3/4 of millennials say they feel gifted at sharing their faith compared to 66% of Gen X and just 59 and 56% of boomers and elders is a huge testament to the fact they're willing and ready to be sort of activated for more spiritual conversations. They just want to make sure that there's not a lot of agenda. They don't want to be you know, a salesperson for the faith.
So one of the concerns I've had just about people in general, as we talk about following Jesus and we understand what it means to be a Christian, to be a disciple, is maybe what we could label a lack of integration or a disintegration of faith into all of life. Are you finding, you know, and that yields itself in contradictions within ourselves, are you finding that one generation is more comfortable living with those contradictions? Is there one generation that actually is living with a greater number of contradictions? Because I see those two stats, you know, as contradictory. I don't know if that's the best word to use, but does that question make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a generation. I've been saying this for, you know, almost a decade now. This is that studying people in general is, you know, because we're social researchers, that it is an exercise in a study of contrast and a study of paradoxes. And that's why I think about this as sort of being perception scientists, that we're looking at the way people perceive their world and then trying to help leaders and, you know, other parents and others make good decisions about seeing the world as accurately as it's as possible. And again, there's lots of limitations to social research, but I think there's so many more advantages by listening to others and learning this sort of spiritual discipline of hearing and seeing what others think and perceive. But I think millennials and Gen Z are more comfortable with that paradoxical sort of style of life, that they don't see the natural inconsistencies, or, you know, when you think about kind of the world of apologetics and the things that they might say, you know, like, well, that's logically inconsistent. It doesn't bother them. It doesn't trouble them. I actually don't think older generations are as troubled as they make it out. It's just that they often use those inconsistencies against young people. But it is important for us to be, I think, you know, clear and, you know, as logical as we can be. But also, one of the things we see so much is, you know, how do we orient people within the church, young people especially, towards the kinds of people they want to become? Let me give you a quick example. I've been working on a new project where we're looking at sort of the relational makeup within churches. And one of the ways we've come to realize the most resilient young Christians, 18 to 29-year-olds, who really don't just stick around with church but actually grow in their faith and grow in Jesus, and, you know, they're the sort of the kinds of young believers we all hope to be and hope to create in our churches and in our homes. And we find that the kind of relationships they have, the kind of relational network, isn't just a set of, continue this idea of, like, it's not just a bunch of logical head knowledge, a lot of informational, you know, like everyone's sort of sharing information with one another. But we actually found that the most resilient young Christians say they actually like being around other older Christians, and that the other older Christians they like being around are the kinds of people they want to be like. And so, you know, that, you know, for me, that's been a measure as I've been thinking about discipling my own kids. How do I help them be around other Christians that they enjoy spending time with? And then also, are there around other Christians that they might really hope to emulate? And again, there's an element of that is, you know, it has its own intellectual, you know, we're to follow Jesus with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. But I think there's also a real heart aspect of that, you know, sort of Jamie Smith, you know, you are what you love. How do we help people orient toward the right desires, not just the right intellectual assertions about the faith?
This is good. We need to take a break. We're talking to David Kinnaman about some of the latest research coming from Barna, and we will be back to continue this conversation with some very insightful and practical thoughts on millennials and really all the generations in ministry. We'll be right back. Here at CPYU, we want to help you help parents stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of our most popular resources is our monthly parent page. This four-page, full-color resource offers parents a timely, practical look into current youth culture trends, along with resources to help them parent their children and teens Christianly in today's rapidly changing youth culture. If you're a youth worker who would like to get this monthly resource into the hands of your parents, you can see a sample parent page and learn more by visiting cpyuparentpage.com.
Thanks again for listening to Youth Culture Matters. We're here with David Kinneman. David, I wanted to just ask a question with regards to Gen Z. I know that you recently did a study on Gen Z, and I'm just curious, in the conversation that we're having around the differences, and specifically I honed in on the idea of sharing one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith, and there was a big jump from Gen X to millennials. Do you have any sort of idea what that might be with Gen Z? I know this wasn't a part of the study, but I'm just curious.
Well, we would have interviewed 18 and 19-year-olds as part of this, because the study for Alpha, the Reviving Evangelism study, was 18 and older. And so we would have had 18 and 19-year-olds. We did not break them out because the sample size would have been too small to look at how they compared to millennials. So I don't have that data handy. A couple big themes. I mean, Gen Z looks similar to millennials in a lot of ways. But they aren't just mini millennials. They really are growing up with some interesting new characteristics as a generation. I mean, for sure, they're more oriented around career. They're more interested in making money and being financially stable. They are children of the recession, after all. And I think that actually was probably one of the defining characteristics for Gen Z in comparison to millennials. And then you also look at things like Shark Tank and other popular popular culture shows that have emphasized entrepreneurship and other kinds of things. There's a lot of differences between Gen Z and millennials. Of course, Gen Z's profile is just now kind of emerging because they're coming, out of their parents' household, parents and guardians' households. And for that reason, they're distinctiveness isn't quite set in stone, but there's a lot of, I think, interesting things and a lot of the same issues as we've been talking about evangelism and sharing your faith. Many of the same concerns of religious pluralism, not offending others, the value of you do you and sort of don't criticize someone else's life choices. Many of those things are just as entrenched among Gen Z as they would be among millennials. So my hypothesis is that Gen Z would be just as concerned about the moral rightness or wrongness of evangelism in very similar ways to millennials.
What are you folks discovering in terms of, remedies to this? What's the pushback to get folks to a more healthy place and a more healthy understanding? And I say this understanding that all generations have issues, all generations tend to exhibit brokenness, perhaps in some unique ways that are, more heavily weighted with some generations than others. But specifically in our work with millennials, we have parents and youth workers listening. How do we begin to remedy this or push back?
Well, there's no silver bullet, but I think there are some postures, some attitudes and perspectives that we need to foster, and then some practices that we can put in place. So, first, among the most important principles that I've learned in the last 10 years of studying and understanding the next generation and now the next generation of Gen Z is this posture of that it is their time, it is their world, it is their faith, and that we can't control them. And we have to be very careful not just to talk down to young people. So I think the first is really to listen and understand why it is that young people are having this allergic reaction to evangelism, because as we've talked about, there's a lot of characteristics about millennials and Gen Z that makes them quite sort of ready for spiritual conversations. And that, I think, is the second point, which is let's actually try to build on some of the things that they're already doing and doing pretty well, and their proclivities to talk about faith and religion and spirituality, rather than condemning them for this this perspective about evangelism that it's wrong. And of course, that perspective needs to be altered, but we can't just say, hey guys, you're wrong about this, so we're going to try to tell you how to really do it. So I think along with those postures of listening to the next generation, understanding their context, realizing that there's a lot of real implicit strengths in how they come at this task of talking about faith, you know, it's to remind and help this next generation understand that actually talking about faith makes your faith stronger, that there's a lot of resiliency in having difficult conversations, that that some aspects of our culture that seem to reflect the notion that you know that it's wrong to criticize others, that actually if you show just the right kind of humble courage, that more people are willing to be challenged or to talk about these things, and that of course the Holy Spirit leads us into those things, and to give people the practice at doing them, and to be more and more you know, aware of and alive to the way the Lord uses us in other people's lives around us. So, you know, I think there's some of the most resilient young disciples that we're interviewing, some of the most exemplar young Christians, are actually really lit up about evangelism. And it's, again, our privilege of trying to help them do more and more of that in the way that God calls them to do it.
Mm. How much do you think, you know, a shift in the church towards universalism, you know, in terms of our understanding of, you know, what happens after, what happens when we die, you know, do you think that that's playing into this as well with these attitudes that you're seeing?
I think so. I mean, and certainly popular entertainment and culture has had a lot of effect on that. I think from public education, which tries to, you know, not sort of highlight differences or to teach people that, you know, how to be, you know, in a religiously plural environment, it sort of strips, you know, kind of bulldozes differences and just says we should all, you know, love and appreciate each other. And in some ways, there's something very biblical about that, that we all have inherent worth as human beings created in the image of God. But again, I think this is an area where we as church leaders have so much work to do. And this isn't a revolutionary thought, but, you know, the notion that we so often emphasize sin and brokenness and our need for a savior within the church and don't equally talk about the Imago Dei and Genesis 1:1-2 and God's good creation of humanity and, you know, sort of helping young people to realize that both are true. I mean, my son is 14. I've been working with him on this discipleship process that I'm, you know, just really trying to spend, you know, 30 minutes or more a day just talking about lots of different things. So this last weekend, we were talking about creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And I gave him some Bible verses and helped him kind of write out some notes in his journal. And we read through, you know, Genesis 1 and 2. And, you know, again, I think so much of our emphasis within our church community is around, you know, kind of your sinfulness and your need for a savior, which is 100% true. But also just reminding young people about, you know, the reason why universalism is sticky, I think, the notion of universalism is sticky is because in some ways we've left our young people open to susceptibility around that because we don't have a strong enough theology of the Imago Dei that, you know, every person, no matter what religion they believe, no matter what crazy things they believe or no matter what they do, is created in the image of God and has inherent worth and dignity. And we need a stronger theology of that in order to combat universalism within our culture and within our churches.
I am curious because you did say they're most resilient and when they're lit up about evangelism. But the as I listen to you speak and you're comparing Imago Dei from sinfulness, engaging that, I am curious how a millennial, when you say the word evangelism and then a boomer hears that, I mean, maybe you're hitting upon that with what you're discussing right now, but there is a dynamic of evangelism when I've shared it with someone who's older than me. And even when I'm younger, it kind of means something different. Is there something to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the huge areas that we talk too little about is the changing use of language and the ways in which language, you know, really does change in emphasis and in meaning and in context. I mean, certainly we have a sort of a living, breathing example of that in the way texting and our, you know, kind of digital conversations are truncated, or, you know, how we use different acronyms for things within texting. So language itself changes. I mean, I think another massive part of what is the landscape is sort of the meme culture and sort of social media, and you know, Reddit and subreddit, and just the ways in which sort of the rise of a snarky style of humor. It's harder than ever to be earnest and to feel like, you know, if you like John Oliver and other videos, you know, there's this sort of undermining of what when someone's having a serious conversation, you know, is it something to be laughed at? So I mean, actually, this is one of the great existential threats to ministry today, which is that for a generation that is, you know, thumbing through memes and, you know, jokes and all sorts of things, we've really weaponized humor in such a way that it's very hard to come into a youth group or even into a family meeting. And, you know, just sitting down and having kind of a serious conversation, it just sort of, it's funny. It's weird. It's, you know, you got to push past the awkwardness. And I actually think that's one of the big challenges is, you know, in this context, the harder you try to convince somebody or persuade somebody, the more it sounds like you're, you know, Michael Scott from The Office, or, you know, you're the buffoon who really is trying to, you know, tell everyone, you know, how it is. And I don't, you know, I don't have a good solution to that, but I think acknowledging it helps us at least to, you know, figure out what might be some of the barriers. And I think language, like, you know, the words that we use, you know, are part of that. I mean, you can almost all of your listeners, certainly, you know, certainly those of us who watch shows like The Office or other, you know, kind of these sort of, you know, just off center, you know, kind of, or, you know, SNL or others, it's like, we're just used to that person who's proselytizing someone, and the how even just the portrayal of that in media. You know, I was laughing. I was at Disneyland a few weeks ago, and the character who played one of the Elaine's boyfriend on Seinfeld, who, if you remember, he was a born again Christian, and he tries to tell Elaine that, you know, she's going to hell, and you know, there's just this hysterical little episode of, you know, of their dialogue about that. And so this generation has many more memories of sort of how pop culture presents spiritual conversations than ever before. They're streaming all of this material, this content. And so I think that's another big challenge in sort of the digital context, is how do we sort of break through, and what does earnestness look like in an effective way? How does persuasion work? So we don't look like, you know, the buffoons that are sometimes portrayed in media.
Putty. It was Putty, wasn't it? That was the boyfriend. In
yeah,
that episode.
That's right.
Putty.
I think it was Putty.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now I'm laughing because I'm thinking about all the different things he was doing. Was that the one where, you know, Jersey Devils, and he was a fan of the Jersey Devils and came up against the windshield and started screaming. He was all painted up going to the hockey game. I don't, yeah.
Funny, exactly.
Funny
exactly.
Stuff. Yeah.
And there was that scene where she's like, well, why didn't you ever tell me? She's like, well, I can't remember his line, but it was something like, I don't know, you're going to hell. I can't help you. You know,
Oh man. Yeah. Well, that so much of that defines for so many, you know, just what the truth and the reality is about faith. And that's so frustrating at times.
And I think we need stronger examples. I mean, even on The Office, you know, Angela, and so often, you know, the Christians are portrayed as hypocrites. You know, Angela is the one having sex, but she's the one who's the kind of on her moral high horse, and it's, you know, it's just the reason why The Office or any of these shows make us laugh is they are true enough. They resonate on some level with the kinds of experiences that we Christians often let people have, which is these awkward conversations about faith. And so, you know, how do we help to reverse that by, you know, actually having better, more productive, more prayerful, more humble conversations about faith? That's really that's what everyone is looking for, regardless of your generation.
That's good insight. Good insight. Well, let's take a break, and we'll come back and continue our conversation with David Kennedy. Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators. Well, we're back with this episode of Youth Culture Matters, where we've been having a very insightful conversation with our friend David Kinneman from Barna, and we have been talking about millennials and evangelism. But if you go on the Barna website, barna.com, you will find that they have posted the results of another survey and some more research they've done on what makes for a spiritually vibrant household. And I read through this and found it fascinating. You know, we understand that parents are the ones who are to be primarily responsible for the spiritual nurture of their children. Warms my heart, David, when I hear you talking about discipling, you know, intentionally discipling your 14-year-old son. That is just awesome. What are you finding in terms of the research, in terms of spiritual vibrancy?
Yeah, this was a really fun study. We just finished it up, came out the last week of, we did the webcast about 3 weeks ago. The last few weeks of February. And so it's called Households of Faith, a new report. And we did the study with Lutheranauer Ministries. Actually, all of my grandparents were Missouri Synod Lutherans. And so it was really fun being able to work with this client that is you know, has some legacy for me just great, great people there. And what we wanted to do was to really look not just at what happens in a local church, which is where we spend most of our time and energy researching, you know, kind of the habits and practices of congregational life. But this was really looking at vibrant households, spiritually vibrant households, and what makes them different than other practicing Christian households that are less vibrant. And so it was a really just a massive study, interviews with teenagers, interviews with practicing Christians across a full spectrum of spiritual vitality. And what we really discovered was about one quarter of practicing Christian households qualified as spiritually vibrant. And by that, we found they were devotional. They read the Bible, prayed, talked about, their faith regularly in the home. And then they were also very hospitable. They had friends and family and, others from, you know, both Christians and non-Christians that came regularly through the home. We found things like the presence of children was a real kind of catalyst for spiritual vitality, the presence of minors. One of the implications was for those households that are either singles living alone, or, you know, couples without children, or, you know, other kind of roommate situations. How do you really integrate other extended household members? How do you bring children into your lives? How do you find, this is what congregations can do so well, is to help us sort of mix up our friendship network, you know, from what can be, you know, we get comfortable in what, you know, in our religious sort of practices. Like my wife and I, you know, our youngest now is 14, in a few years, you know, he'll be out of the house. So we've been thinking about, okay, what is our household going to look like, you know, when the kids are out, not just empty nesting, but how do we actually stay spiritually vibrant? You know, the motivation to go to church, you know, changes or whatever. So just a really neat study around how having fun and quality time and just all these different interesting ingredients of hospitality and, what kind of faith you grew up with, whether you were Christian when you grew up or not. I mean, all these different, how these things interplay. So I'm really proud of the work our team did on this study. I think it's going to help a lot of leaders and a lot of parents and a lot of church leaders really understand, you know, how do we actually, what are the ingredients we can mix around to create a more spiritually vibrant household?
So as I look at the infographic here, which is fantastic, and people need to go and look at this. Very well done. The thing that really is jumping out at me is, you know, the percentages that are highest in terms of what people are identifying, most of them relate either to spiritual disciplines, prayer and Bible study, right? And then the others are in this category about a spiritual coach. A spiritual coach is present. That is fascinating to me. Unpack that, the whole idea of a spiritual coach. And I'm assuming here we're talking about dad and mom.
Well, it can be anything. I mean, dad and mom serve that role most frequently in households with minors. But it can actually be a spiritual coach of any relationship, okay. even a non-familial relationship. But recognizing, you know, sort of a household member talks with me about God's forgiveness. A household member teaches me about the Bible. A household member teaches me about traditions. A household member encourages me to go to church. So those were some of the things that kind of qualify under that spiritual coaching rubric. And yeah, this particular infographic is one of my favorites. We've used it now a couple of times. It's like a pinwheel infographic. You can actually find it on our website. The actual article is called "What Makes for a Spiritually Vibrant Household." You know, I'm always, you know, as a dad, I've got three kids: one at university, one just finishing high school, and one beginning high school. And you know, the research that we do is it works on me too. And you know, looking at this infographic and the data, I'm, you know, looking at ways in my own home and in my own, you know, in our own church, how can we do more of this? And so it's fun. I think these very practical examples of what does it look like, you know, these five factors of a spiritually vibrant household were spending fun, quality time together, having a spiritual coach being present or having a coaching mentality, welcoming others. That's the hospitality component we were talking about, asking for help. Meaning we the spiritually vibrant households are more likely to sort of put up their hand and say, we actually want someone to help us either, you know, with moving or outside help or, you know, getting help with finances. And then members have a personal spirituality. I mean, there's a devotional activity. So, you know, the very practical specific things that we included in the research helped me as a dad, me and my wife, to actually have, you know, well, what are we doing or what are we missing? What are the things we could do that we're doing well that we could do more of? And so I think that kind of very practical ways of reflecting on the research is really helpful for us. And it has been for me as a dad.
Jason.
You know, one of the things I see in this is that's so interesting is the dynamic of outside influence, because I'm thinking mind, body, soul, spirit, and the thing that I think often gets left out. I know a lot of families that do mission statements, and they want to have a home that is spiritually vibrant. But what I find, the two things I find that are really fascinating: one, there's activities. There's a lot of activities. There's a lot of outside activity. But then there's also, you mentioned hospitality, but when you also see close friends. So there is this dynamic of getting out, but then also bringing people in. And specifically, when you say close friends, is that something that they're seeing? Like they're seeing, kids are seeing their parents have deep, intimate friendships? Or is that among the children?
Well, I don't know offhand. I'm not sure. I think the best way to answer that, and we probably could do some cross-tabulation and look at some of that, I think the main thing to answer is that relationally, there is a greater sensitivity to the need for it and the presence of relationships across the whole family system, the whole household system. That, by the way, was one of the real insights for us, was that household concept is a higher order than the family. And families are great. They're wonderful, God-ordained. But that if we looked at the New Testament, if we looked at our current context, you know, sort of like, you know, Modern Family, the television program, that really it's like the modern household, and that household is a richer concept, a more biblical concept perhaps, or at least another way for us to think about our current world and the kind of the households that comprise our churches and our communities, you know, because not every family I should say this, not every household is a traditional family. Not every household is a family, but every family is a household. And you know, a church is no stronger than the households are that it's comprise it. You know, we have to look at each of these individual households as sort of the basic unit of spiritual transformation. And on that level, to answer your question as specifically as I can, you know, without having the data right in front of me, I can't look at, you know, whether we're looking at children's relationships or family relationships. But across the full range of the things we're looking at, the more robust your relationships can be, and the more you want to be around these other Christians and want to be like them, the more vibrant your faith is the bottom line.
Hey, I know we're winding down on time here and you've got responsibilities. You've been great, you know, and generous with us. I want to just one more question here. You and Mark Matlock, what are you working on? You've got something that you're getting ready to release that sounded pretty exciting.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it's a new book project called Faith for Exiles, and it's actually dealing with a lot of the themes we've been talking about the last hour, and the notion that we describe our current context as digital Babylon. It's the, you know, it's the meme culture. It's the power of these shows. It's the emphasis on experience and, you know, less on reason or rationality. Really the gods of our age are superheroes, and the conversion experiences happen through media and entertainment and technology. And so, you know, Digital Babylon is a new, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, but there is this screen age that we're all trying to lead in. So we've been doing research on what makes for resilience among 18 to 29-year-olds. I did two books called Unchristian and You Lost Me that looked at a lot of the problems facing this next generation, but this book really looks at a lot of the solutions. So it's 5 ways for a new generation to follow Jesus in Digital Babylon. That comes out in September of this year. You can actually go to faithforexiles.com and look at some of the tools. We're building a couple of cool e-courses. Mark Matlock, a great friend, more than 20 years. I've been friends with him, and we produced a couple of e-courses, one for parents, one for pastors, and then the book will be coming out. But it's a lot of our own, you know, there's a lot of despair about this generation. I mean, we started this whole conversation around the fact that millennials seem to think that evangelism is wrong, but in the midst of those discouraging findings, I actually find a ton of hope in these resilient disciples, what they're doing, why they care, how much they love Jesus, how much they love the church. They're charting a different path than I think many of us would have thought or expected, but I'm just greatly encouraged by, you know, the quality and consistency of their faith. And this book is a lot about the testament to what those— it's only about 10% of young 18 to 29-year-olds who are resilient disciples, but a real testament to what's making them tick and what's helping them to stay resilient. So it's a pretty exciting project, and we're looking forward to launching it coming up in September this year.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Jason, any parting words?
No, I just want to say thanks, David. Appreciate a lot of the research and the work that you're doing, and just even the time that you've spent here with us. This is super helpful.
Yeah.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And as we always do, if you go to our homepage, cpyu.org, find the page for this particular podcast. There's a player in there. You can listen to the podcast from our page. If you're listening with another podcast provider, you may want to, when you're done, come back over to our place, and then you can see links. Chris Wagner will post all the links to everything that's been mentioned and more, especially these articles David's mentioned from Barna. And we want to recommend as well that you tell others about Youth Culture Matters. We want to invite you to listen into our 1 Minute Daily podcast as well, Youth Culture Today. You can get both those wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe to them. Give us a good review. That helps us, and tell others about it. So thank you, David Kinnaman. Blessings on you in your work. You've resourced so many of us so well for so long, and we want to continue to encourage you to keep on keeping on and doing this. So thank you.
Thanks, Walt. That means a lot to me. And Jason, great to talk today.
Yeah. All right. So we will talk to everybody again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.